BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is a download from the BBC. For more information, visit bbc.co.uk/radio Wales.
It's 8 o'clock on the 19th of October. This is Sunday Supplement, our weekly look at the people and politics of Wales and beyond. Bore da, I'm Vaughan Roderick. Well, Welsh universities are facing massive financial challenges. So what does the future hold for them? I'll ask the eminent KC, Elwyn Evans, who chairs the umbrella body, Universities Wales. Meanwhile, the United Nations is marking its 80th anniversary this week. But is it still relevant in 2025? One man thinks it isn't.
Not only is the UN not solving the problems it should too often, it's actually creating new problems for us to solve. The best example is the number one political issue of our time, the crisis of uncontrolled migration. It's uncontrolled.
Donald Trump, of course. We'll hear about the role of a Pontypool man in the creation of the United Nations. Meanwhile, Kemi Badenoch's pledge to leave the European Convention on Human Rights marks a seismic shift in what was a consensus in British politics.
To me and the Shadow Cabinet, the resulting policy decision is also clear. We must leave the ECHR and repeal the Human Rights Act.
Well, the former Justice Secretary and Lord Chancellor, Sir Robert Buckland, disagrees. He'll be joining me later and says the policy is a profound mistake. And we'll speak to a retired nurse who spent 3 years solving the mystery of a World War I painting which found its way from a Cardiff hospital to Sandhurst. Well, Welsh universities stand at a crossroads, burdened by rising costs, falling numbers of Welsh young people going to university, and a funding model that apparently no longer adds up. Institutions across Wales now face a collective deficit of more than £70 million, with job cuts, course closures, and restructuring becoming the new normal. Well, the Welsh Government did announce a further £28.5 million for higher education in February, but it seems the future of the sector in Wales depends on bold reform. I'm joined now by Professor Elwyn Evans, KC, Vice-Chancellor of the University of Wales, Trinity St David's, and in August she was appointed Chair of Universities Wales, which represents the interests of all of the Welsh universities. Good morning, bore da.
Bore da, Vaughan, and thank you very much indeed for the invitation to join you this morning. Greatly appreciated.
Well, I'm glad you came on. If we look at the universities, is it fair to say they've been facing a perfect storm?
That's one way, I think, of describing a situation. I think it's one of these areas where there are different tones of describing the situation that universities face. But ultimately, I think we have reached a point where, as you described it in your intro, it no longer adds up the way that the financial sort of substrata of the whole system works. However you categorise it, we've reached a point where we need to review it.
And the reason for that is that for a very long time, the fees universities could charge domestic students were frozen, leading to a dependence, over-dependence on students from abroad. And, of course, those numbers are very dependent on things like exchange rates, visa regulations and all sorts of external factors.
Those are certainly some of the significant drivers around our situation at the moment. I suppose there is a sort of bigger landscape that has brought us to where we are. And that's basically, you know, we're all independent organisations, all 8 of the universities based in Wales, and of course, the Welsh element of the Open University, so 9 in total in Wales. We're all charities, but we operate in a policy framework that comes from the Senedd, because, of course, education's devolved, comes from Westminster, because, of course, higher education very much crosses Clawdd Offa, and we also operate in a global context. So all of those elements in different ways have impacted on the reality of university finances. And so our request, you know, for a review, and I suspect we'll be coming on to looking into the future, it is in no way political. It's probably based, I think, on the way you've described of a financial system that no longer adds up.
For someone from outside, you know, the picture of the university is, I guess, for some people, still the ivory tower. But the point you make in the manifesto you published as Universities Wales this week is that this is a major economic driver. It's not something that sits aside from the everyday lives of people in Wales.
Absolutely not. And I don't think it's some people in Wales. I think everybody in Wales, in different ways, are impacted by its universities. We'd want more people and more young people and more students to be directly impacted by being students within the HE sector. But as it is, the impact of our universities is enormous. And I'm not sure we've been very good as a sector in banging that drum. And forgive me, I'm really not good at interviews. You'll have guessed that already. And I feel quite a sense of responsibility in representing the sector in your programme this morning to try and get over that message of how important universities are. Whether you're looking at the 11 billion almost contribution that universities make to the Welsh economy annually, I could go on with the statistics, but that's not really helpful, is it? I mean, the bottom line is that this is an incredibly important, impactful sector in its places, in its regions, in Wales and beyond. Absolutely.
And yet, the number of young people entering higher education in Wales is dropping. And, you know, you can see why. If you're 18 years old and you're from a stretched financial background, you know, your family hasn't got much money, and you look at the numbers of the sort of debts you're going to be ranking up, and you're reading news stories that maybe graduates aren't getting the sort of jobs they used to get, you can see why young people are being put off.
Vaughan, it's a really significant point you make, and one of the three. So we've got three requests, in effect, we are making in our manifesto, four reviews. And one of those requests is absolutely around participation in HE in Wales, and actually probably beyond that from 16 upwards, although, you know, I speak on behalf of Universities Wales, so I'm focusing on the HE sector. So what we're suggesting is necessary is an independent commission on participation in HE in Wales. We know the figures. We know how concerning they are. And we will all have, I suspect, our own entirely reasonable views as to why that's the case. But we feel that it would be really wise and prudent to have an independent consideration of why it is that the figures are as they are. And that also, I think, maps over into what is our first request, really, in the manifesto, seeking a cross-party support for an independent review of the university funding, but university funding and student support. So that plays absolutely into your point about students' perceptions.
Should that also be looking at encouraging Welsh students to go to universities in Wales? Because if we look at the way the university sector works, it's sort of more an England and Wales setup at the moment. You know, a lot of students cross the border to go to English universities and vice versa, and the money follows them both ways. And yet, if you look at Scotland, if you look at Northern Ireland, it's far more a case that people go to a university within their own country, and particularly in areas like, let's say, medicine. You know, there's a lot of evidence that if we want doctors to stay in Wales, the people most likely to stay are people from Wales, educated in Wales. So is that something we need to be looking at?
Vaughan, your point is one that is very well made and raises a really significant series of questions. I'm here, obviously, in that umbrella context and in a non-political position as well. And so, of course, we need to look at what is sometimes called that jagged edge of devolution, and the one I referred to earlier as part of that policy landscape within which we operate as a sector in Wales. And yes, of course, there are different models in Scotland, Northern Ireland. And we know already that there are differences between the political parties as to an approach that might be considered the right approach for the funding model in Wales. And so I'm not going to, the Welsh word, I'm not going to step into that landscape. That's why we are saying let's have a cross-party independent review of university funding and student support. Let's look at it. Let's weigh up the arguments and hear everyone's voice in that debate.
Professor Elwyn Evans, thank you very much. Diolch yn fawr. Well, the Senedd Caerphilly by-election is shaping up to be a far more than a local contest, but it's more of a political litmus test. Labour has held the seat for over a century. But if opinion polling and punters are to be believed, the party has a real fight on its hands with both Reform UK and Plaid Cymru aiming for what would be an historical upset. Well, Professor Laura McAllister is from the Wales Governance Centre at Cardiff University. She specialises in Welsh politics, elections, devolutions and electoral reform. Good morning, Laura. Bore da.
Bore da, Vaughan.
It's a humdinger, this one, isn't it? I mean, I've heard it being described as easily the most important by-election of this century so far. I mean, does it deserve that, Billy?
Well, that's probably a little bit hyperbolic, but I get the point as well, because the truth is, Vaughan, this is a local contest with huge national insight and implications, and it effectively signals a significant change at the moment, as we're seeing it, in the voting habits of the Welsh population. To see the polling, and we know polling can be inaccurate, and we know all the caveats about the real poll being this coming Thursday, but to see Labour and the Conservatives languishing in third and fourth place, a long, long way behind Reform UK and Plaid Cymru, is quite significant, isn't it? So whatever the outcome on Thursday, I think we're going to be unpicking that for quite some time, and it has significant implications for what follows, of course, 6 or 7 months later in the Senedd election.
We've had by-election upsets before, haven't we? Not just in Wales, but England, Scotland as well. And then things sort of default back to the norm come the Westminster general election. The thing is with the Senedd election, though, next year, I guess because it's not a Westminster general election, the by-election result could spill over far more.
Yes, absolutely right, Vaughan, because, you know, we're seeing a comparability in many senses between a by-election for the Senedd and the actual Senedd national elections next May. What we're talking about there is obviously turnout levels, degree of media interest, which has historically been very low around the Senedd elections, but also the opportunity that voters feel to vote negatively in the sense against a party. And of course that plays very, very badly for Labour, because they have the double whammy of an unpopular Keir Starmer government at UK level and an unpopular Welsh government with Eluned Morgan as First Minister here. And I think that's the real pincer effect for Welsh Labour, which has seen the party consistently now poll around 12 to 14%, and not only is that, you know, a really problematic figure for a by-election if that were to be translated into votes, but even more so for the Senate elections, because the new electoral system that we'll be using has a floor of around 15%, which actually, if anything, if any party doesn't quite meet that share of the vote, is heavily, heavily penalised in terms of the seats it could win. And we could see a situation, if polling is correct, of course, we could see a situation where Labour and the Conservatives just have a handful of seats in a larger 96-seat Senedd.
It's extraordinary when you think about that, isn't it? Because they used to be the... It's quite a cruel term, but it used to be called the donkey vote. You know, the idea that if you put a red rosette on a donkey, people will vote for it. That there was a flaw to Labour's support, particularly in the industrialised, post-industrialised now areas like the South Wales Valleys, like Deeside, and so on. That seems no longer to be the case. That voters. Generally now, not just in Wales, are more like sort of consumers. They'll go quite happily from Tesco to Sainsbury's rather than being wedded to one or other of them.
Yeah, I think that's true, and that's a good analysis of what's been going on over the last decade. Voting has become much more transactional. People ask what a party will do for them personally rather than feel it's a historic or cultural or identity-based choice. And that's kind of ironic because we know that lots of the reasons for supporting, particularly in this by-election, Reform UK and Plaid Cymru, are based on an individual's sense of national identity. But there's no doubt at all the wider picture is much more transactional. And I think that's caused all kinds of problems for Labour. But the other thing, Vaughan, which, you know, we talk a lot about, is that once there is a narrative of the desire or need for change, the incumbent party has incredible difficulties. We saw that with the Conservatives at the last UK general election, and I don't doubt that we will see this both in the by-election and in the Senedd elections next year, because it's almost impossible for Welsh Labour to present itself as a party of change when it's been in power for so long. And if the public desire change, that's the basis on which they will vote.
It's interesting, though, that from Labour's point of view, that I mean, they did have a choice. They've chosen to sort of link the two governments together to talk about the benefits of a Labour government at either end of the M4, whereas they could have gone another way and said, look, we don't much like Keir Starmer's government. We don't like what they're doing. We're Welsh Labour. We're different, you know, which is what Roderick Morgan did. If the results are as polls suggest, and, you know, polls are polls, so they can be wrong. It looks like Welsh Labour may have made the wrong choice.
Or there isn't sufficient support for that strategy within Labour in Wales. And, you know, you talk about Welsh Labour. Welsh Labour has been a brand that's been very, very successful, you know, in terms of its kind of soft national position on more powers for Wales and Welsh identity. But what we've seen over the last 2 years, Vaughan, is a real battle for the soul of Labour in Wales. And I'm not sure that Welsh Labour dimension that was epitomised, of course, by Roderick Morgan and carried forward by Carwyn Jones as well, is in the ascendancy now. And if that's the case, then there was no real desire to put forward an alternative model of Labour in Wales. And of course, that was compounded by claiming that there would be real material benefits of having a Labour government at UK level and at Welsh level without any strategy or any promises for demonstrating that. It seems incredible to me that there was no real deal struck between Wales and Starmer over what benefits would be shown and manifested for Wales. And of course, that's the situation that Eluned Morgan has found herself in now. No returns on anything she's asked for, and that's an incredibly weak position to be in.
I mean, I do find it fascinating that they banged on, made all this noise about, you know, things like HS2 consequentials, devolution of the Crown Estate, devolution of criminal justice, all of these things, without having sat round in a room somewhere and worked out what they were going to get so as they could play down the things they weren't going to get.
And exactly, that reveals exactly the kind of hierarchy in the relationship between UK Labour and Welsh Labour. And I'm afraid that's going to come back to bite it in the by-election and in the Senate elections. It seems incredible, doesn't it, that one party can't have bottomed out the challenges that lay ahead for its own party in one of the nations of the UK. I too find that quite incredible and completely unstrategic, because of course if Labour does lose Wales in the Senedd elections next year and it doesn't win Scotland, that causes all kinds of real problems for Starmer, as well as potentially poor performances in the English local elections. And all of that, of course, could have been handled very differently, particularly in the Welsh case.
Laura McAllister, thank you very much indeed. Well, that by-election, fascinating by-election, takes place this coming Thursday. You can find a full list of candidates on the BBC Wales News website. Well, the Conservative Party's pledge to leave the European Convention on Human Rights pits sovereignty against decades of legal tradition and political consensus. Framed as a solution to illegal immigration, the move is championed by party leader Kemi Badenoch, who insists the ECHR is holding Britain back. Here she is spelling out her policy at the party conference earlier this month.
It is fundamental. Why can't we control our borders and remove those who need to go? All these questions boil down to who should make the laws that govern the United Kingdom. And so to me and the Shadow Cabinet, the resulting policy decision is also clear. We must leave the ECHR and repeal the Human Rights Act.
Well, critics warn that leaving the ECHR risks undermining worker protections, the Good Friday Agreement, and Britain's reputation as a defender of human rights. Well, even within Conservative ranks, people like my next guest are raising serious concerns. Sir Robert Buckland is former Conservative Justice Secretary and Lord Chancellor, also chaired the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee and a Welsh Secretary as well. Whole host of titles, in fact. Robert, good morning.
Good morning, Vaughan.
Why is Kemi Badenoch so wrong?
Well, I think that my party have pressed the nuclear button before actually thinking carefully about the other options that still exist in order for us to deal with the clear and serious problem of illegal immigration, and also to understand and recognise that if we do decide to leave the ECHR, we will be unique amongst nations in Western Europe in deciding that that is the solution to a problem that is besetting countries from Greece right through to Denmark. It's striking that none of those other countries dealing with this problem are saying that withdrawal from the convention will be the magic, the silver bullet that will solve this problem. I think that this is the reddest of red herrings. It would be far better to focus on the Refugee Convention, which was written at about the same time as the European Convention on Human Rights, and the definition of safe country within that convention. That is causing a problem, not just for us, but for countries right across the world. Work on that instead, and I think that will unlock some of the problems that have beset us in recent years.
And yet there have been cases using the ECHR, haven't there, in terms of people using the right to a family life, for instance, as a reason not to be deported?
Well, yes, but overdone. There are actually, in fact, very few examples where in the last 40 years or so, Britain has been found in direct contravention of the Convention on Article 8 grounds. There have been tensions. We have acted domestically to change the law, to tighten up the use of this. And some of the cases that are reported as abuses of human rights, for example, the Chicken McNuggets case, remember that one? Theresa May's cat, remember that one? They're all misreported. When you actually read the details of the judgments, the grounds are something different. Even the Rwanda case, which is used all the time as an example of the European Convention intervening, actually was nothing to do really with the convention. It was more about whether Rwanda was a safe country that would stop the return of people to countries of origin. That's what it was about. So let's actually focus on the evidence here, have a cool head on it. I think at its height Kite Vaughan, the way in which the court interprets Article 3, the prevention of torture article, and the way it sort of gold-plated that, I think, is an issue. But again, instead of walking to the door and leaving, why aren't we working with other countries to change that? It can be done, and I think that would be a better option.
What does it say about the Conservative Party that not only is withdrawing from the ECHR policy, but now that if you disagree with that policy, if you're Robert Buckland, for instance, you wouldn't be allowed to stand as a Conservative candidate?
Well, I think that's unfortunate, to say the least. For years, we had a policy of, for example, of being strong supporters of our membership of the European community, the European Union. We were, when I joined the party, we described ourselves as the party of Europe. There were plenty of colleagues who wanted to withdraw from the EC, EU. They were allowed to stand, quite rightly, because we are a broad church. I would urge gently but firmly my friends to think again about the wisdom of that course. A Conservative Party that doesn't, it's not really about me, it's about people like me who believe that the Conservatives are at their best when they represent a wide swathe of the common ground of politics and attract a coalition of support that isn't just its traditional base, but people, reasonable-minded people, who want a competent government that can manage the economy. And the irony is, I think in her economic approach, Kemi Badenoch is absolutely hitting the right mark. I thought it was a strong speech at the end of the conference, and I think the Conservatives are working hard to regain that trust. It's going to take a while, of course, but you know, I thought that was a positive, and I think this has detracted from it.
And on this issue, you use the term broad church. I mean, is there a danger of becoming a narrow sect, you know, that keeps wanting to withdraw from things, you know? We'll withdraw from the European Union, people can judge what the result of that was. Oh, well, let's withdraw from something else then. I mean, you just keep withdrawing.
Well, I think so. I think the Conservative Party has always had an internationalist streak to it, a belief that when we engage with the wider world, we make Britain not just politically more influential, but economically more influential. And, you know, I want to see our economy grow. I also want to see the Union of the United Kingdom preserved. And my worry about this argument about the ECHR is that it ignores the Northern Ireland dimension at its peril. Now, whether we like it or not, I'm a unionist, always have been, always will be. But when the Good Friday Belfast Agreement was drawn up, and let's not forget the work of Paddy Mayhew and John Major in the build-up to those years, it was absolutely recognised that the nationalist Republican community did not have faith and trust in the police service or in our security services. And the reason why you see the Human Rights Act, and in particular the Convention, which of course existed at that point, that the Human Rights Act was still coming into law in 1998, was to assure and reassure the nationalist community that there was a shared sense of values and rights. And that's why the settlement worked, the Police Service of Northern Ireland was created. You've got now that shared trust. If you start breaking that down by withdrawal from the convention, the sort of that will, I think, provoke potentially a border poll, which could really undermine the union. And I do not want to see my party, either deliberately or inadvertently, be the architect of the breakup of the United Kingdom. That goes against everything that Conservative and Unionists believe.
Yeah, you call it my party, but is it really your party anymore, do you think? I mean, do you feel at home in today's Conservative Party?
I will always be a Conservative. I think that it is absolutely vital that voices like mine, that tradition of one nation conservatism, is heard loud and clear. We have now populist alternatives on the right that are pretending to be conservatives. They are nothing of the sort. And if people want to have a proper centre-right alternative in this country, which I think is desperately needed, then the Conservative Party will remain the best vehicle for that. And
I asked you that, Robert, is you know, if we look at the political map, there's a whole swathe of constituencies across the south of England that, if you like, were sort of Remainer Conservative constituencies. Mm. They were rock solid, safe for the Conservatives, but most of the Conservatives they voted Remain. And those have all gone Lib Dem, or not all of them, but a lot of them have gone Lib Dem yellow now. And is there a danger that those constituencies are never going to come back if the Conservative Party stays on the ground that it is, withdrawing from this ECHR, you know, competing with Reform and forgetting that they've got the Lib Dems snapping at the heels in other parts of the country?
Well, I think that, you know, to focus unduly on Farage and Reform is to ignore those type of voters. You know, it's not about the Conservative Party focusing on other parties. It's about the Conservative Party focusing on the voters and remembering that when it is competent, when it displays economic competence, when it displays that sort of calm approach to politics that God knows is desperately needed in these wild times, then people will respond positively. I think the reason why people, first of all, either voted Lib Dem or other parties in the South and other parts of England, or more importantly, Vaughan, stayed on the sofa because they couldn't bring themselves to vote Conservative. They couldn't bring themselves to vote against the Conservatives, but they couldn't vote for the party in the last election, is where we need to focus. Let's think about the voters first, and let's exude that calm competence that the Conservative Party was renowned for, which of course was the winning formula. Now, I'm not saying just because it works in the past means it's going to work in the future. And, you know, the world is changing constantly. Politics is very fractured, as we just heard from Laura's excellent analysis with you just now. But that does not mean that we should just, you know, give up and say that the future of the centre-right is in this shrill, let's leave everything, narrow nationalism, which is just not the hallmarks of the Conservative Party that I've been a member of for so long. You know, Churchill, Macmillan, Thatcher would not recognise this type of approach. She understood multilateralism and the need to be an international force. If we retreat into this narrow sect approach to politics, we are going to reduce Britain's political and, most importantly, economic influence in the world. We will not grow our economy. We will not be able to pay for public services, and we will all be poorer as a result. Now, I don't want that, and I certainly don't want to see my party leading us down that cul-de-sac.
Sir Robert Buckland, thank you very much indeed. Well, 80 years ago this week, in the aftermath of a world torn apart by war, the United Nations was born out of hope. A bold promise to future generations that peace, dignity, cooperation would prevail over conflict and division. Well, as the UN marks its landmark anniversary, that promise feels both urgent and fragile. From the crisis of climate to humanitarian emergencies in Gaza and the war in Ukraine, the ideas that shaped its formation are being tested like never before. The UN's effectiveness is also being questioned by the likes of President Donald Trump, who cast doubt on its capabilities in a speech at its headquarters in New York last month.
I have ended 7 unendable wars. They said they were unendable. And sadly, in all cases, the United Nations did not even try to help in any of them. I ended 7 wars, dealt with the leaders of each and every one of these countries, and never even received a phone call from the United Nations offering to help. Not only is the UN not solving the problems it should too often, it's actually creating new problems for us to solve. The best example is the number one political issue of our time, the crisis of uncontrolled migration. It's uncontrolled. Your countries are being ruined. The United Nations is funding an assault on Western countries and their borders.
Well, among the UN's earliest architects was a man called Sir David Owen. No, not the Labour Foreign Secretary. This one was an economist originally from Pontypool who helped build the organisation from scratch. Well, joining me to discuss the beginnings of the organisation and its future is Craig Owen, who manages the archive at the Welsh Centre for International Affairs at the Temple of Peace in Cardiff. Good morning.
Good morning, Vaughan.
This Sir David Owen, I must admit, was a name that was new to me. Tell us a little bit about him.
So David Owen was born in Pontypool, and he became a rising star through the diplomatic service through his career. But he catapults into the limelight on the UN story because quite early during the war, quite a lot of Welsh peacemakers and activists have been very engaged in trying to shape ideas on what a post-war world might look like with peacekeeping apparatus and so on. And following conferences in 1941 and the floating of the idea of the United Nations by President Roosevelt, the task of pulling together a secretariat for that mythical being was delegated to Gladwin Jebb of the Foreign Office, and as you say, David Owen supporting him. And he described himself as Jebb's deputy. Jebb had apparently said that he'd handle the high diplomacy. You take on the rest, find an office and a secretary, get this thing started. And literally from scratch.
It was him and a typewriter, basically.
Apparently not even a typewriter. He described himself as rushing back to London to borrow a typewriter from the Foreign Office and a secretary from the War Office. Together they headed in a taxi to Westminster, knocked on a door, and the guard demanded to know who they were, and they said, "We are the United Nations," and that was the beginning. And they financed the early days of operations with a £30 loan from his own London bank account, and literally started cobbling together the great international institutions that we now know today.
It's interesting when we look at it. You say he was from Pontypool. His father was the minister of Crane Street Baptist, which was a very famous sort of classical building in the centre of Pontypool. I wonder whether that sort of Welsh nonconformity and all that had happened before the Second World War with things like the Temple of Peace, where you work, played into his beliefs and his politics.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's easy to forget that many of the institutions that emerged out of the Second World War and that have shaped our world ever since. The United Nations has a whole network of institutions from development programmes to UNESCO and so on. But the ideas for them all of course, came from somewhere. And during the interwar era, the League of Nations movement, which is the predecessor to the UN, that was a huge peace movement in Wales. For example, some of your listeners will have heard over the last year, the centenary has been marked of a women's peace petition campaign to America, which in 1924, nearly 400,000 women across Wales petitioned America and worked with the women of America to try and get them to play a lead role in the League of Nations. And America at the time, of course, was very isolationist and so didn't initially take that role. But interestingly, a lot of the people involved in that campaign, as you start to move forward through the archives, you realise, oh, these are the people who actually become the architects of the United Nations. A lot of the ideas that had been bubbling up from Welsh peace movements, from Welsh educators, from women's movements and so on. A lot of the ideas for solutions to international cooperation that were considered too radical or too difficult to do in the 1920s and 30s, all of a sudden they became the blueprints that the world needed for a new world order as they were trying to look at the problem of what do we replace all of this with. And so many of those people, including David Owen, were then very quickly brought in by the Allied powers over the course of World War II to help shape that landscape and to come up with the world that then came into being once the United Nations was officially created in San Francisco in 1945.
The acronyms have sort of became part of everyday language, UNESCO, UNICEF, and so on, the Blue Helmets, all of that sort of stuff. But 80 years on, probably the organisation is being questioned in a way it hasn't been before.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's, I mean, the UN remains the world's only truly global forum. It's indispensable, but imperfect. I mean, the greatest strength is its universality. Its greatest weakness is its inability to act decisively when its powerful members disagree. And that's as true today as it was during the Cold War era. I think one of the things which often gets lost in a lot of the heat versus light of debates about the UN is a lot of the strengths are just rather taken for granted because they've always been there. That having that global convening place to bring the countries of the world together, the humanitarian and development achievements and programs that the UN have managed for decades, and just all of the norms, treaties, international laws, every country's framework from development goals to legal powers all hang off the international architecture that the UN provides. So, no, it's not perfect, but without it, the world would be far more dangerous, divided and unequal, and reforming it isn't really about tearing it down, but it's about revitalising the only institution that's really capable of uniting humanity in our common purpose.
Craig Owen from the Welsh Centre for International Affairs, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Well, as we've just heard, Wales's peace movement after World War I was driven by a deep desire to never repeat the horror of the trenches. From chapel pulpits to mining communities, voices rose in protest against future wars, not just with banners, but with quiet conviction as well. And that spirit of compassion is captured powerfully in one particular painting, Care of the Wounded, by the Welsh artist Margaret Lindsay Williams. The painting had hung for decades at Cardiff Royal Infirmary, but by chance it was spotted by a viewer on a TV programme at the Royal Military Academy in Sandhurst. That led the retired nurse who'd worked at the infirmary as a student on a 3-year quest to find out the history of the painting and why it ended up where it is. Well, Pam Jones now lives in Hross-on-Sea in Conwy, and she joins me now. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning.
So you first came across this painting as a student?
I was a student in Cardiff Royal Infirmary in 1974. And I knew it hung in the entrance hall of the hospital. And I nursed the sister from that painting. She was a patient. And one day she asked me, where was Mamet's ward? And I told her it was being renovated. And then she asked me, would I do something for her? Would I go and look at the painting? I didn't know who she was. I went to the hall and I saw the painting floor to ceiling, read the names, and I looked at her in the painting and I thought, gosh, it can't be. And as I walked into the ward, she was watching the door. She pulled me in and she said, Pamela, did you see it? And I said, yes. Is that you, Mary? Yes, she said, that's me. Wow, I couldn't believe it. She gave me a big hug and a kiss. And she said, I've got something else to tell you. What's that? I said. And she said, I went on to be assistant matron at this hospital. I almost died. She was a very lovely lady, yeah.
The painting, which people can see if they look it up online, as you say, it's very large and it's very distinctive. You know, anyone who remembers the CRI will notice that very distinctive architecture the hospital had. But CRI, it never closed entirely, but it closed as a general hospital. And then the painting suddenly, not disappeared exactly, but no one quite was across where it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I gave a lecture on Wednesday in Cardiff. And luckily for me, the lady who found it was a Mrs. Mary Reed. She trained in Cardiff and she was an army reservist. And she came to Cardiff in 2005 when the hospital reopened. And she asked them, where was the painting? And they didn't know what she was talking about. This lady took it on herself to search. She found it in the chapel. And it was in a bad state. She negotiated...
This is the hospital chapel?
Yes, and she negotiated with Sandhurst, and they negotiated with the hospital trust, and it was taken to Sandhurst. It was cost them £70,000 to restore it. And it's now hanging in Robertson's house, which is in the Sandhurst estate. And that is for the Royal Army Medical Services, the Royal Army Veteran Corps, and the Queen Alexandra's Nursing Service.
And the artist who painted it, because, you know, this is it's a wonderful painting, and it's not a hack artist who painted this. This is very distinguished Welsh artist.
Oh, yes. She was born in Cardiff, and she lived in Barry. Her father was a shipping merchant. And she, at the age of 16, she went to Cardiff Art School and landed up in the Royal Academy of Art in London. She went on to paint many distinguished royal families of our royal family, the Queen, 5 times, the kings before her. And she never married. She painted presidents of the United States, everybody. She was a very famous lady, yeah.
Given that the painting was rotting in the chapel, it's wonderful that it was saved at all, but it is sort of a pity that it's in Sandhurst, isn't it, rather than back where it belongs?
Well, you know, I give a lecture on Wednesday, and a lot of the old staff turned up, and doctors, and yes, people were very upset that that's where it's ended up. I did try, when I saw it on the TV, to ring the Cardiff Museum, and I did try ringing the Hospital Trust because I wanted to know why was it there, and nobody came back to me. So I actually rang Sandhurst and spoke to the curator, and they wanted me then to tell them the story of the painting, but I feel it's safe. Where it is now, it's safe.
And that, you know, and that's the main thing, isn't it? But you can see why people would say, well, yeah.
It belongs in Cardiff. And it could have gone to the museum. It could have gone to the City Hall. It could have gone to St. Fagans. I think it was because it was so large. Where were they going to put it? I don't think it would have fitted in the University Hospital. It would have looked out of place. I don't want to comment on it because, you know, I don't want to set off a bonfire here.
No, and, you know, Sandhurst paid for the restoration. So you know, there's that as well. Pam, thank you so much for speaking to us. If you do want to look at that painting, see what it looks like, it's called, I'll repeat the title for you and the artist, Care of the Wounded by Margaret Lindsay Williams. Well, with us to look through the morning papers and websites now, we have Myra Tosais, former head of news at the Welsh Government, and Reverend Eldon Phillips, the Llanelli Scarlets team chaplain. Guys, it feels like ages since I've seen you. It's so nice to see you again. Myra, would you like to kick off?
Well, there's only one game in town this morning, and that's the prince formerly known as the Duke of York. The stories are on every front page. I've chosen a story in the Mail on Sunday. They're leading with an exclusive that Prince Andrew embroiled the Metropolitan Police in a campaign to smear Virginia Giuffre. A leaked email exposes that Andrew asked his taxpayer-funded Met bodyguard to investigate Virginia Giuffre and passed him her date of birth and confidential social security number. This happened apparently just before the infamous picture of Prince Andrew and Virginia Giuffre hit the press. So it's an attempt apparently to smear her. There's so many stories in the papers this morning about him. The one thing that strikes me about his statement on Friday when he relinquished his royal titles and other royal duties, and in every aspect of this story, is never once have I seen any expression of sympathy or compassion for any of the victims of Epstein and Maxwell. And I think that's something that could have been done without admitting any kind of guilt or liability.
Eldon, what have you seen?
Yes, Sunday Times, page 9. A bit disturbing, this story. Harvest now, decrypt later. Beijing has stolen data on every British citizen, security experts warn. The GCHQ intelligence agency says that the data has been gathered in a years-long unrestrained campaign of malicious cyber activity by state-sponsored hackers. Very disturbing story, this one. Dr. Peter Radnilev, specialist in encryption, says that Britain is far behind the curve. We don't have the capacity to deal with this. I know very little about this story, but it's quite disturbing, isn't it?
It certainly sounds it. Myra?
Yeah, I was going to add to that. I mean, we just give so much of our data away as well, don't we? Quite voluntarily, every time we use social media, but it is scary stuff. Fly tipping is a story that crops up very frequently. I've picked up in The Wales on Sunday this morning two related stories. First of all, that new Welsh Government statistics show that Bridge End Council hasn't taken any action against fly tippers in the Bridge End area since 2015-2016, despite a recorded total of 1,500 incidents of fly tipping last year alone, but no prosecutions. The council say that there's been a reduction in the number of fly tipping incidents, though not a significant one by the looks of it. And they said that the lack of prosecution for fly tippers is down to a new focus being placed on prevention and education. And in a related story, really, in Newport, which has been branded as Wales's fly tipping capital by some, the council is considering introducing a new policy for abandoned shopping trolleys that could see supermarkets being charged £100 for their return. Newport, and the area that I live, has been blighted really by illegal waste dumping, with more than 7,000 incidents in the last year. And it does make you wonder when the charges that are placed on people driving vans and commercial vehicles in the tips are so high, whether some, as well as prevention and education, consideration could be given to making it perhaps less, more affordable for people to tip.
Sure, but some of those roads around Wentlook and the old LG site and things are truly shocking. Eldon?
Yes, as you know, Vaughan, I'm a rock and roll clergyman and a rock and roll story, of course. The Mercury Prize, The Observer, page 15. The Mercury Prize seals the star power of loyal Geordie Springsteen. Sam Fender has become a world-class singer-songwriter. He won the prestigious Mercury Award this year for the best album of the year, defeating Fontaine's DC from Dublin, as I'm sure you're aware as well. He comes in a long line of famous singer-songwriters from the North East of England. We think of Sting and Alan Price and Alan Hull of Lindisfarne, so a bit of a rock and roll story there.
And really interesting subjects for songs as well. A lot like Springsteen, as you say. Moira?
I've picked up a story called Crop This. Farmers let it all hang out for mental health. Farmers are following in the footsteps of those doughty ladies in the WI by stripping off for a charity calendar. They've posed naked with strategically placed butternut squashes, sunflowers, and even a couple of chickens to cover their modesty. So farmers are raising money for mental health charities, but also to raise awareness of poor mental health within the farming community, which, you know, apparently is down to isolation and other pressures on them. The calendars go on sale shortly, priced at £12, so I'm sure they'll be a massive hit.
That's a pound a month. a bargain.
Bargain.
Yes, Sunday Times has got a campaign today on how do you draw in reluctant young readers. There's a number of pages dedicated to this. The paper asked a lot of celebs and literary scholars, literary celebrities, what influenced them originally. Sir Philip Pullman, for example, said it was Emil and the Detective. detectives. Douglas Stewart said it was Daphne du Maurier. Now, Moira and I discussed this, Vaughan, and for me it was Enid Blyton, it was Just William, it was Billy Bunter, and for you as well, Moira?
Enid Blyton, Just William and Noel Stretfield.
I count Emil and the detectives, but also I go for Jennings of Derbyshire.
Oh, yes.
And Dr. Doolittle.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot Billy Bunter.
Myra, you have 30 seconds for one last
30
story.
Seconds. Sacked as Santa for being fat, a professional Father Christmas is facing a bleak festive season after he's been told he's too fat to fit into his costume. Weighing in at 20 stone with a 46-inch waistband, Mike Mendoza has played Santa for years, but he's had his contract cancelled with Lapland UK for not fitting into his costume. Mike says he feels fat-shamed and says, whoever has seen a skinny Santa?
Oh, well, he needs to get on an elf kick, doesn't he? You can listen again to this programme on BBC Sounds, the app for music, radio and podcasts. And don't forget, you can follow all the political news stories on Radio Wales Breakfast from 7am weekdays and Politics Wales later this morning on BBC Wales.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.